I begin each week by just reminding you of the positive thesis that this class is affirming. There are no clobber texts. There are no attention here to get at anybody. It's an attempt to defend what from Genesis 1 and 2 is the biblical thesis about the appropriateness of human sexuality within marriage. Marriage should be honored by all, and the marriage bed, sexual relationships, should be pure, holy, within that context. And the negative implication of that is also stated in the same verse, because God holds people accountable who take what is holy and out of its context make unholy that which he has meant to be the bonding element of a marriage relationship, where there is as intimate and deep a communication, verbal and nonverbal, in the experience of sexual union as two human beings can share. God will judge the adulterer, the person who breaks covenant or induces another to break a marriage covenant, and any sort of sexually immoral conduct. And that covers that word, porneia, sexual immorality. Sometimes in the King James Version, I think consistently was translated fornication. But it's a broad word that indicates any sexual congress outside the commitment of a husband and wife in marriage. Well, here's where we left off in developing that thesis last week. I told you I would try in 2 weeks to cover a wealth, really, of historical material that is covered in the big book, not the little book that you have. The big book, the 400 and something page book, that's the one if you weren't here. Myra said, okay, I'm glad we got that one finished, but now write one for me. The book that you have, The Ink is Dry, is the one that was written for Myra. And she let you have copies of it if you chose to as well. But the big book has two rather long chapters with lots of footnotes and original source quotations to prove what I'm going to be able to show you in summary fashion tonight. The historical context of the biblical material, much of it produced here in what we call the intertestamental period, some of it before the Old Testament canon would have closed, some of it before the New Testament's written, some of it contemporary with the New Testament, which makes it perhaps even more important, will show you that historically there is nothing new or unique about the issues that today we sort of lump under the LGBTQ plus umbrella. Gender dysphoria was known. They didn't use that term. They didn't use the term homosexuality. That term is a 19th century term created in German. And in that same book, heterosexuality was created. I mean, these are vocabulary terms. It's not concept terms. The term homosexuality, heterosexuality, asexuality, all were created by a German writer, and I think the year was 1869, gets into American publications in translation from that. But the fact that a vocabulary word appears that was not there before does not mean the experience is not described. In fact, in the biblical text, we were looking at Leviticus. You don't need a word. It's described. It is prohibited for a man to lie with another man as one lies sexually with a woman. Well, that's just a description of the event. The word in different languages, of course, would vary, but that word comes into German and then into English. But the fact that the terms are 19th century terms doesn't mean that the experience described by that late vocabulary word was not known 1,000 years before Christ, in the time of Christ, in the 10th century. These are not new issues. They're not unique. I'll show you tonight that transgender issues were very much a part of first century discussion, and certainly same-sex, gay and lesbian relationships. Before we leave it, this is an article that I would sometimes use in ethics classes. I won't take much time with it, but last week I introduced to some of you a term that you may not have known, pederasty, the pederastic relationship, the older man, younger man, in Greek culture was institutionalized, and it was a way of mentoring young men into careers, law, rhetoric, various other fields of academic study. They didn't have universities. They had sort of like Jesus and the 12 or Socrates and his little band of disciples, Plato. They were mentored, but the erastes eromenos relationship, those are the Greek words for it, very often translated in English translations, the lover and the beloved. And those terms, I think, were rather euphemistic in those translations that were done in the 18th and 19th century. And they were not meant so much to disguise, but in the 18th and 19th century, people didn't use language quite as, sometimes we say coarsely, or I might just want to say as directly and clearly as we do today. The erastes was the adult male lover and mentor to an eromenos, who was usually a pubescent somewhere in the range of 13 to 18, 13 to 20, who was tutored and mentored into a profession by that. Somebody says, can't imagine anything like that ever being a part of a culture. This is an article from the New York Times. PBS has done two visual specials, two one-hour specials on it. There's a contemporary practice in Afghanistan, most notably this article, called Bakabazi. And it's the sexual exploitation of pubescent and some prepubescent children by adults, usually in these cultures, simply by, let me just read the article. U.S. soldiers, headline, told to ignore sexual abuse of boys by Afghan allies. The reason we're here is because we'd heard terrible things the Taliban were doing to people and how they were taking away human rights, said Dan Quinn, a former Special Forces captain who beat up an American-backed militia commander for keeping a boy chained to his bed as a sex slave. Quote, but we were putting people into power who would do things that were worse than the Taliban did. That was something village elders voiced to me. Captain Quinn, for beating up the warlord who had kept the boy chained as a sex slave in the compound, he was dismissed from the military because they had not respected the cultural norms of the Afghan people. Quote, at night we can hear them screaming, but we're not allowed to do anything about it. My son said that officers told him to look the other way because it's their culture. Rampant sexual abuse of children has long been a problem in Afghanistan, particularly among armed commanders who dominate much of the rural landscape and bully the population. The practice is called Bakabazi, literally boy play. And American soldiers and Marines have been instructed not to intervene, in some cases, not even when their Afghan allies have abused boys on military bases, according to interviews and court records. You saw the movie Kite Runner. You saw some reference to it, although it was not older adult, just older boy against younger boy. There are still cultures where this sort of abuse, this sort of thing that we would just call unthinkable to our culture. The historical context is going to show you that there's nothing new about what happens with same-sex relationships, both abusive and those done by consent. Left off last week saying the historical argument has changed in recent years. Writers like John Boswell, in his book Same-Sex Unions in Pre-Modern Europe, From the Dust Jacket, a work of paramount significance, this book is described, Same-Sex Unions in Pre-Modern Europe irrefutably demonstrates that same-sex relationships have been sanctioned and even idealized, the institutionalized form of it in Greece, in Western societies for over 2,000 years. That was the argument up until about 50 years ago. We shouldn't be bothered about same-sex experience, gay and lesbian experiences, transgender experiences. There's nothing new about them. they not only have been here, they've been idealized and institutionalized. About 50 years ago, the argument changed, and the current version is publicly known and sanctioned same-sex unions don't have historical precedent. We don't know them from antiquity. 50 years ago, Boswell, Lewis Crompton, Boswell teaching at Yale, Crompton, if I remember correctly, teaching at the University of Nebraska, his book, Homosexuality and Civilization, published by the Harvard University Press, all very conservative church-related documents that would, you know, hardly at all. The current version says, no. It's not that they were common and institutionalized, even idealized. They were simply unknown. James Brownson, in the ancient world, such ongoing permanent relationships between persons of the same sex are, watch the language, never documented in the extant literature of the period. And then a New Testament scholar, Robin Scroggs, quote, it's certain that pederasty was the only model in existence in the world of this time. That proposed by 20th century gay liberation movements was, without question, entirely absent. That's the claim we're going to test tonight. We go first to that book that I just referred to and held up for you, Boswell's Same-Sex Unions in Pre-Modern Europe. And this is from that book, page 80. He describes different types of same-sex relationships. He describes pederasty, the older and younger, older male, certainly describes some of the more abusive, obscene ones, rape after an army is defeated in war to, quote, humiliate and feminize defeated male soldiers and warriors. A fourth type of homosexual relationship known in the ancient world consisted of formal unions, that is, publicly recognized relationships entailing some change in status for one or both parties, comparable in this sense to heterosexual marriage. Cicero, though notoriously straight-laced, persuaded Curio the Elder. Cicero, by the way, is contemporary with Paul. Cicero persuaded Curio the Elder to honor the debt his son had incurred on behalf of Antonius, to whom the younger Curio was, in Cicero's words, quote, united in a stable and permanent marriage, just as if he had given him a matron's stola, close quote. Stola was the sort of the, not the veil that one would wear in a wedding today, a woman, but it was the drape of womanhood that was put on a woman at a wedding ceremony to indicate she's no longer a girl subject to being pursued and wooed by others. She now is married and she belongs to this family. Never documented, not known. There are lots of documentation. I'll show you by no means all of it. This is a chart I put together. It's a very selective chart. It begins at 730 BC. It goes down to the 3rd century AD. It begins with two men who in Greek and Latin poetry are celebrated for their enduring love over time and their faithfulness to each other and held up as a model. The last one, Elagabalus, he was a Roman emperor interested in being able to change. He asked physicians, did they know how to change his sex? How he could become a woman? Because he was involved in same-sex relationships with men, and he really thought it would be wonderful if they could figure out the medical means, surgical means, by which he could become a female. The note says he was obsessed with the idea of changing his birth sex to female. And Elagabalus is sometimes cited in contemporary literature as an early person who understood that gender is fluid and that he was passionate about the the pursuit of transgender. We can't go through all of those, so I just have to select these. The first, I've grouped three together, and I may have them really in the wrong order because I list a work of Plato third, but a lot of scholars believe that it was what Plato says in the Symposium that is behind the Boeotian yokemates and the so-called Sacred Band of Thebes. The Sacred Band of Thebes, some of you, I bet, know a little bit about. It's interesting. After that, we'll talk about the cult of Cybele. Cybele was a Parthian goddess that around 300 BC was introduced to Rome. It was a curiosity. It was one of the so-called mystery religions. The mystery religions were not so much secretive societies as they were highly ecstatic. A lot of them would use intoxicating drugs. Worshippers would get into a frenzy. The worship events were quite wild and so on. And the last one we'll look at, if we have time, is some of the evidence that comes to us from the destruction of Pompeii. As many of you know, Pompeii destroyed, I think it was in AD 79, by a volcanic explosion that essentially froze that town in time. And frescoes and paintings, corpses of humans, horses attached to chariots, it's as if they were put in plaster cast because it caught them so off guard and froze them in time. Hopefully we'll get to that. Let's begin with Plato. I call Plato my friend because I spent 3 years of extensive time with Plato in graduate school. And I was in Michigan, and a young man came to me, and we hadn't been talking about the subject. He just, out of the blue, said, you know, my professor in class recently made the point that same-sex relationships were just absolutely unknown in antiquity. There's no documentation of anything that even resembling same-sex relationships on a committed basis. I said, really? And that was a class in, I think it was a class in English Lit. I don't know how they got to discussing ancient Greek culture. I said, well, I've actually spent quite a bit of time with a Greek writer named Plato. Have you ever heard of his dialogue, The Symposium? Well, no. Well, The Symposium is Plato's account of one evening of an event that was fairly commonplace in Greek culture. The plural of symposium is symposia. Symposia, or if you prefer, symposiums. Symposia were regular features of sophisticated Greek life. And in Plato's Symposium, other Greek writers write documents called the Symposium. But in Plato's Symposium, there are six speeches. And then there's a summary where Socrates, always the hero of Plato's dialogues, recounts what Diotima once told him about the subject matter. The subject for discussion in that symposium, and by the way, that's the way a symposium typically would run. Men would get together, they might be waited on by women who were serving, cooking, and cleaning up, but men would get together and they would drink a while, and then there would be a subject for discussion, and everyone who was at the symposium was allowed to make his contribution. In Plato's Symposium, the subject is Eros. Eros, with a capital E brought into English, is the god, the Greek god of love. And in Plato's Symposium, there are three pairs of male with male lovers. One of the pairs is Pausanias and Agathon. They had been in a committed and exclusive relationship with each other for 32 years at the time of the symposium. And it's Pausanias' speech in particular who explains the nature of meaningful love. There's some beautiful things said in Plato's Symposium. Preachers have sometimes been known to, because the language is poetic and beautiful, preachers have used it in marriage ceremonies, not realizing, I think, that it is in praise. Yeah. It's beautiful, but it's talking about the erotic relationship of males. Remember the great chain of being? Males are halfway between pure spirit, pure matter. That becomes relevant in Pausanias' speech. Pausanias, don't get lost in trying to read ahead. I'll read it to you in a minute. Pausanias distinguishes between what he calls a vile man who is a vulgar lover with the superior sort of man whose love is pure and grows out of a right character. He says the vile man, basically, wants to have sex just to have the experience of an orgasm. They didn't have the word orgasm in Greek either, but that's what he describes. The good man doesn't just use another male, boy or adult, to have an orgasm. He said that's vile. That's selfish. That's a misuse of eros. By the way, they viewed eros as something of a dynamic energy that welled up within a person. And he said a vile lover just wants to release that energy in an orgasmic experience. But he says a man of character is not so self-serving as that. He's not after just a physical sensation. Now, this is important to Plato because Plato believes in a sort of dualism where the spirit of a human being is encapsulated. Socrates and Plato would even say trapped within. It's the reason why I hate the song "I'll Fly Away." I think it's more Greek theology than it is Christian theology. In Christian thought, body and spirit are fused. We are either inspirited bodies or embodied spirits, whichever way you want to. It's not the sort of Greek idea of dualism where the good part of you is the spirit and this old stuff that it has to live in is heavy and dense and drags it down. And if you don't live well in this one, you might come back as a woman. But if you live better, you might come back as a lower level God. Okay, not to get too distracted. But that distinction between a vile man and the use of erotic power just for self-gratification is different, he says, from the one who sees in the beloved something that is really wonderful. And the focus is on the intellect and the possibilities for good in that other person and this passion within the lover for the beloved is not just temporary, short-lived, erotic explosion. It's, if we use the word in our language, true love. This is the way at 183D he describes it. To give oneself to a vile man in a vile way is truly disgraceful behavior. By contrast, it is perfectly honorable to give oneself honorably to the right man or to a good man. Now, you may want to know who counts as vile in this context. I'll tell you. It is the common, vulgar lover who loves the body rather than the soul. The man whose love is bound to be inconsistent, since what he loves is itself mutable and unstable. The moment the body is no longer in bloom, quote, and he quotes a Greek poet, he flies off and away. I'll fly away. No, it's not where the song goes. He flies off and away, his promises and vows in tatters behind him. This is the person who just uses another person. How different from this, my underlining, not Plato's. How different from this is a man who loves the right sort of character and who remains its lover for life, attached as he is to something that's permanent. Pausanias has been in a relationship like that for 30 years. And he looks back, and you know, there's truth to what he says, however you consider the expression of love. There's a cheap way to love. Man can pay a prostitute and have an orgasm. But to find someone that intellectually, emotionally, in all other ways, you feel a genuine attachment for, bonding for this person, and express that through erotic drive. He says the former is vile. This is what is good. Who loves the person out of the right sort of character and remains the lover of that person. Loving the body, yes, but loving the soul, loving the heart, we would say, loving the personality more than just being titillated by the body. And that's why he says, that's why in so many, when the young boy begins to be a man, there was something about, and this is constant in the Greek literature, if you're a vile person, you're ready to change out your lover when he starts developing a beard and facial hair and pubic hair, is no longer beautiful, young to you. And it's time to let that person go. Pausanias says, not if you've loved for the right reason to start with. Pausanias knows, and he's not the only one, the nature of long-term commitment that is different from going to the brothel or paying a prostitute. Growing out of the symposium, scholars debate this, and this is not anything that I'm particularly up on or knowledgeable about to have a firm opinion, but a lot of scholars believe that it is what comes out of the symposium that generates what comes to be known as the Sacred Band of Thebes. Thebes was another of the city-states of Greece, like Corinth, like Athens, like Sparta. Thebes was another important city-state back in the era of Socrates, Plato, Aristotle. Most of you probably know they have an interrelationship. Socrates was Plato's teacher. Plato was Aristotle's teacher. Aristotle, by the way, was a teacher to Alexander the Great and set him on his military path of imposing Greek culture on the world, elevate the rest of the world. This is a quote that, in order for you to read it, it flows over two screens. The tomb of Aeolus in Thebes became a pilgrimage site for male couples. Now, just pause there. Let me explain that. The book that you see pictured here by James Rahm, the book was published, I don't know, 6 years ago, something like that. It's gone through several editions. A couple of movies have reflected parts of the story of the Sacred Band of Thebes. The Sacred Band of Thebes forms in Thebes because the tomb of Aeolus in Thebes, Aeolus and Heracles, not Hercules, the mythical figure, Aeolus and Heracles were lovers, male lovers. Their story was celebrated in poetry and music throughout Greece, so much so that when they died, rather heroically defending each other in battle, and they were buried at Thebes, there's multiple documentation for this. Male lovers would come to their tomb in Thebes to pledge their vows to each other, their sacred vows of commitment. very much like a marriage ceremony. Greeks didn't do marriage ceremonies the way we do. You go somewhere before a priest or a civil magistrate, or sometimes just before your families, and you would express your vows. The tomb of Iolaus in Thebes became a pilgrimage site for male couples. According to Plutarch, who cites Aristotle as his source, men pledged their love for one another beside that tomb as if the bond between Heracles and Iolaus were their model. We will be as loving and faithful to each other as Heracles and Iolaus were. The quote continues from Rahm's Sacred Band. In no other Greek city do we hear of such vows, but then Thebes was unique in how it regarded eros, sexual love, between men. Now, he doesn't mean, as you'll see in a moment, we don't hear about this happening anywhere else, but we don't hear about this feature. Male eros took many forms across the Greek world, as Plato attests in his meditation on the subject, Symposium. In Athens and Sparta, male eros was complicated, as Plato has one of his speakers, Pausanias, declare. But among the Boeotians, that's Thebes, Pausanias claims, referring principally to the Thebans, male pair bonding was embraced and even encouraged by law. Now, I can't tell you, and Rahm doesn't, it says, I can't quite be sure how it was encouraged by law. That was what was unique in Thebes. Male same-sex commitment, long-term commitment, was common throughout Greece, but somehow in Thebes it was encouraged by law. I don't know what that means. I don't know if they got a tax break. I just honestly can't tell you. Nor could Rahm, he admits. No one there, neither young nor old, would say it is shameful, Pausanias says, adding that this cheerful acceptance was also seen in Elis in the Peloponnese, another Greek city-state. Two other Greek writers, our principal sources for classical Thebes, confirm this phenomenon. Xenophon, a contemporary of Plato's, claims that, quote, among the Boeotians, a man and a youth lived together suzergentes, Greek word, suzergentes, yoked together, a word that elsewhere refers to a bond of lifelong marriage, close quote. The Sacred Band of Thebes was a fighting unit formed in the 4th century BC, perhaps out of the suggestion of Plato's Symposium. We're just not sure, it's debated. Because Pausanias goes on to say in his praise of men loving each other that if two men love each other, he just ventured that if you ever formed a fighting unit made up exclusively of pairs of lovers, they would go out onto the battlefield in a way that normal warriors didn't. Because with your lover as your side by side with you or in battle, back to back with each other, defending each other, the last thing you would do is play the coward because you're protecting your lover's life. It's not that your wife is there with you and you're, no. These are all male pairs. My beloved, if they get me, they're going to get him. He said they will be braver, more courageous, more steadfast. And he said the one thing you would never see is a man letting his lover see him run in the face of danger when there's a battle. The sacred band of Thebes became legendary. Small band, 150 pair of male lovers, sacred band of 300 fighters. They fought, they were formed originally when Sparta was threatening Thebes. And the experiment, whether it was prompted by Plato's statement in Pausanias' mouth in Symposium or not, Gorgidas was the one who formed the sacred band. He recruited male lovers, trained them, we would say indoctrinated them the idea of you are fighting for your beloved and each of you is protecting the other's life. As small as they were, they repelled a Spartan invasion, and they were at the heart of the fight. There are three or four other major conflicts that are fought, that Rahm documents in the book, where they fought courageously. They were finally wiped out by Philip II of Macedon, Alexander the Great's father. And Philip erected a monument at the battle, celebrating the courage that he'd never come up against such brave and courageous and noble warriors as the Sacred Band of Thebes. Some people had questioned whether or not the story of the Sacred Band was really historically accurate, because it just, over a period of a little more than half a century, always at the forefront, always brave, monument erected to them. The Battle of Chirona, I'm doing this from memory, I think it was the Battle of Chirona where Philip defeated them. And the soldiers were buried in a mass grave. That grave was discovered a while back by archaeologists and excavated. And the warriors were buried by pairs in various stages of embrace. The Sacred Band of Thebes. The idea that there was no historical precedent. It is Chironea, Chaeronea, yeah. And the Battle of Chironea is where they were overwhelmed and they were buried. Now, I hope I don't get fired for the next three slides I'm going to show you. I don't think I will, because I've masked part of each. I've shown you a quotation from Plato's Symposium and Boeotia was the region, the Boeotian yoke mates, this word Susurgentes used, of married couples, heterosexual and homosexual couples. Same word used of both of them in the literature. Sacred Band of Thebes, particular case of clearly not just same-sex personalities, but bonded same-sex persons over time, deep commitment, loyalty. Another of the sources that is traced by a professor at the University of Southern California, professor of classics, I'm sorry, University of Texas, professor of classics at the University of Texas, homosexuality in Greece and Rome. And he says, in addition to, and he gives a lot of the literary evidence, I'll read you a short quote in a moment, he gives a lot of the literary evidence and more. I mean, he deals with the Symposium extensively. He deals with the Sacred Band of Thebes. He says, but something that a lot of historians overlook is the art from that period. He said, same-sex love is celebrated openly in art, plates, vessels for cooling wine, that would be set in cold water, decorated on the outside. Greek homosexual activity, this is from Hubbard, I think page 5 or 6, despite popular misconceptions, was not restricted to man-boy pairs, pederasty. Vase painting shows numerous scenes where there is little or no apparent difference in age between the young wooer and his object of courtship, as well as graphic scenes of sexual experimentation between youth. You see where I put the banner, so I'm trying not to get fired. I've only been back here for a few weeks. This one is, I would call, a typical plate showing pederastic involvement. How do you know the older man? How do you know the erastes? Got a beard. How do you know the pubescent male? He's smooth-faced, and I mean, just his bodily form. Okay, pederasty was very much a part of Greek culture, institutionalized and approved. Here is one of those cooling vessels for wine. What do you have here? Smooth-faced characters only. These are adolescents. Maybe they're adolescents doing what adolescents do. Maybe they're experimenting with their sexuality, toying with their sexuality. I don't know. This is simply a depiction from the period. What is this scene? Well, it's what Bronson and Scroggs and others say is never documented from the period. It's not pederasty. It's not teenage boys horsing around or experimenting. What are the facial features here? These are adult males. Now, these are three examples of literally hundreds of all three sorts. One of the more famous pieces of art, which I just did not have the courage to show you. The British Museum has it on display. They paid $3 million for it. It's called the Warren Cup. The Warren Cup is a silver chalice. It's only about 7 or 8 inches high, but it is meticulously detailed with two very explicit and graphic scenes of same-sex intercourse. Scholars argue one of them clearly is an older man with a younger man. As the cup rotates on the opposite side, it appears and is argued by some art scholars that these are now two older people and that the cup celebrates the ongoing relationship between the Erastes and Eromenos, the mentor and mentee, that over time develops into their adult relationship, both of which framings on the cup are too explicit for me to show to you or to want really to see. Let's move to the cult of Sybil and move away from... And by the way, those plates and amphorae, we look at them and we think, that was sort of an ancient version of pornography. Well, it was. And yet, the evidence and what historians and archaeologists say, to them it was not pornography at all. It was celebratory art. Because, and I'll get to the quotation in a moment from that comes from two or three sources, that in both Greek and Roman life, the issue was less, are you having sex with someone of the same or a different gender? The issue was beauty, not male or female, but the beauty of the physical form. And that's why especially older men seem to have been drawn to young, strapping, pubescent males in their physical prime. And some of those over time developed just as, and I don't know that I saw this treated anywhere in any of the people saying that the only form of male-to-male lovemaking was older man to younger man. In those same periods of time, how did romantic relationships, erotic relationships form between men and women? Forty-year-olds to 40-year-olds? 25-year-olds to 25-year-olds? 18-year-olds to 18-year-olds? No. Mary and Joseph, what is their relationship? And they're a Jewish couple. Joseph disappears. We typically assume why. It would have been customary within Jewish culture, the man, before he contracts a marriage with another family, he's old enough to be established in a job and a career. Joseph was a tectone, a builder, mason, a woodworker, whatever that word means. Mary appears to be the age that this most girls were in Jewish culture when they were married in that period, probably in her early teens, 13, 14 years old. When Joseph drops out, we're not surprised. He maybe, 15 years older, 20? We don't know. not given ages. But we do know that was the norm, not just in Jewish culture, but in ancient cultures generally. A family would marry off their young daughter, usually contracting for the marriage well before the time of the marriage, to a family where someone was established in his farming or as a builder or whatever. And so the fact that pederastic relationships, older to younger man relationships, and that some of those ended when the vile lover saw somebody else that he thought was prettier, male or female. Same thing happened with older men and the younger girls. You court her while she's young and attractive and marriageable and able to have babies. She may have three or four, and she may have stretch marks, and certainly if she gets a little older, she gets some wrinkles, and he might trade her in. Well, that still happens. That's not just an ancient technique. So it occurred to me in reading that well, but it was all pederastic. Well, a lot of it was, but opposite sex relationships were age differentiated very often. But a lot of those men and women, older man, younger woman, they stayed married for life. It happened a lot with the male couples as well. Let's move to the cult of Sybil to get one other issue on the floor. The cult of Sybil was one of those mystery religions, ecstatic, a lot of jumping and hooping and hollering and probably some drugs to get it on. And a number of what today, like the term non-binary, I'm neither male nor female, I'm non-binary, or transgender persons, they claim historical precedent or identity with people out of the cult of Sybil, especially the priests of Sybil. Sybil's priests were known as the Galli, Latin. These men wore yellow or multicolored robes with a tiara and, quote, adorned themselves with ornaments, rings, and earrings. They wore white makeup and curled their long hair. I give a citation for it. Look up the Encyclopedia Britannica. I did anything. Just look up the cult of Sybil. The priests of Sybil, in order to become a Galli, you had to be castrated. You could be a member of the cult. You could go to the festivals and the parties. But if you were a priest, and all of the literature says the castration had to be self-administered. I can't imagine wanting to be a priest badly enough, but evidently some did. And the tool that they used can be found in a lot of museums. It's a gruesome-looking tool. It's large enough one could use it on himself like a big... you've seen the police on The Rookie. They cut a chain with it. It's a big device like that. Okay, enough of that. My point is, the notion of being transgendered, it's not just Elagabalus, this Roman emperor, and Nero also was in that number. Nero had two marriages to males. One of them, he had the one that he took as a wife castrated. The other, he did not, so that he could play, according to the Roman historians, he could play the female in the second marriage. But the cult of Sybil clearly... yellow or multicolored robes, tiara, ornaments, rings, earrings, white makeup, curl their hair long. There's this strange passage in 1 Corinthians 11:14 where Paul talks about, and this was used a lot when I was a teenager in the church that I grew up in to make the boys get haircuts with some frequency. Doesn't even nature itself teach you it's a shame for a man to have long hair? And so, you know, we didn't let it get down over our collars. And when the Beatles became popular in the hair, you know, a lot of sermons, and I probably preached two or three of them, or 10 or 12, I don't know. about, you know, you don't do that, Paul says. There were lots of cultures in the New Testament era where men wore long hair. Romans, typically, their hair would be cut, well, not like some of you, a little longer than mine, probably. But if you've seen the busts of Julius Caesar, Augustus, whatever, you know, they don't have draped hair. But German men traditionally wore long hair. Stoic philosophers in Greece. One of the ways that you tell a Stoic, if you were in Athens and around the Areopagus, the guys who had really long hair, they were probably Stoic philosophers. And that's where it became popular in the 60s for people who were philosophy majors to wear long hair and sandals. That's not true. That's just a bad joke. But various cultures and schools of philosophy or whatever, long hair was not unknown. I wonder, you read commentaries on 1 Corinthians 11, a number of scholars of the New Testament, of which I am not one, would say, you have to wonder if Paul is not saying in 1 Corinthians 11, not that a teenage boy can't let his hair get over his shirt collar, if Paul is not in that very text, because in the larger text of verses 2 through 16, he's talking about male-female relationships. If he's not in fact saying there, you do not want to identify. They didn't have the term transgender then, just like they didn't have the term homosexuality or heterosexuality. But you have to wonder that could be background to Paul's comment about the long hair, that would be an identification with this sort of move, not distinct to the cult of Sybil, but probably best known there. And the cult of Sybil was in any number of cities and cultural settings. In the Roman period, And they sort of flow together. We talk about Greco-Roman culture, and we really have been earlier. I mentioned Cicero's contemporary of Paul. The Romans took a different attitude toward male sexuality than the Greeks in a couple of ways. They did not generally practice pederasty the way the Greeks did. I've used the term, the Greeks institutionalized it. And I called it part of their educational motif. An older man would mentor the younger boy into his trade or profession. That was not adopted in Roman culture, because in Roman culture, it was considered demeaning, and I apologize for this, feminizing, for anyone to be the receptive partner in a male-male sexual experience. And that's very anti-Roman. What is the Roman notion of being a man? It's that masculinity. It's the soldier. It's the warrior. It's going out to fight for Rome. And anything that appeared effeminate. And that's why typically, even the Roman hairstyle would not have been the flowing locks of the priests and cultists of Sybil, because the passive partner was considered, and repeatedly in the language, paraphusin, unnatural, which is a term we'll run into the New Testament, was considered unnatural and feminized. And some physicians, we don't have Galen's document, but some reference to Galen, the famous Roman physician, but Rufus, who was also a Roman physician, quoted for a long time into the medieval time, said, we have to wonder what causes some men to desire that experience. He said, sometimes it must just be a bad habit like biting the nails, but he said, you have to wonder sometimes if it's not a defect from birth. It's an orientation one is born with. Another of the claims made, they had no idea, no concept of, no one ever talked about an orientation to a same-sex relationship. John Clark, in his book, and John Clark is a professor at the University of Texas at Austin, an art historian, by the way, not a theologian. Quote, until the Emperor Constantine paved the way for Christianity to become the state religion, 4th century, Roman attitudes toward sex remained relatively stable. Most people saw sex as a wonderful pleasure to be pursued. Ecstatic sex with a beautiful partner, whether male or female, adolescent or adult, was a gift of the gods, one of life's most important moments. That is a theme in both Greek and Roman writers, that the issue is not, do you love a man or a woman? Do you see the beauty that is in that person? And is it that beauty that you are pursuing and want your eros, your erotic drive, satisfied by beauty? Male or female was not the issue. Beauty was the issue. Finally, and we have 3 minutes by my watch. We're going by mine. In a chapter in the book that I've just read from, Clark's book, Roman Sex, one chapter is titled Gay Sex in Bi and Straight Company. Clark is himself a revisionist. He's not anti-gay and lesbian relationships at all. He's a revisionist of a different order, claiming that Roman same-sex culture has been given too little attention because of 19th and 20th century prudishness, that when Pompeii began to be unearthed, a lot of the more beautiful scenes and frescoes were destroyed because they were too erotic for the archaeologists digging them up. And he documents that with claims about they destroyed them because it just wouldn't do for them to be seen by contemporary people. And some were put away, smaller ones, in a vault that Clark had access to, and he reproduces photographs from them in his book. And they are gross. Scholars could not bring themselves to believe that such hardcore images of gay sex could have existed in ancient Rome. A specific comment on the Warren cup that I described earlier, the silver chalice. Quote, it did not take much sleuthing to find many male-male sex scenes that I could date to the same period as the Warren cup, and notes the dates, 81 and 30. Who lived around that period of time? Oh, that's the period of the adolescence of Christ. And I found a whole range of images of gay sex on a variety of vessels of the period, and he reproduces in the book, in color, not just plates and wine cooling devices of the sort that I showed you earlier, but frescoes and carvings in ivory, pottery, molded pottery. That would be hardcore pornography in any culture at any time. A wider comment that he makes, second from the bottom, these bisexual cups and bowls from 30 BC to AD 14 helped me to establish that ordinary people prized beautiful images of explicit, straight, and gay sex. And finally, like all Romans, the ancient Roman man worshipped beauty in both male and female bodies and strove to have sex with beauties of both sexes. Common theme from historians, archaeologists, and art historians that theologians seem to have missed, who want to say they just didn't know this sort of experience back in those days. The single most important book on this subject is written by a professor at the University of Oklahoma named Kyle Harper. It won the award in the year of its publication, which was 2014, the Award for Excellence from the American Academy of Religion, and was published by the Harvard University Press as a volume in its, quote, Revealing Antiquity series, very prestigious and very expensive series of books. This book has actually made it to the popular press. Harper, and the page number for this quote is page 35. But the most intriguing novelty by far is the evidence for male-male marriage in the early empire. If we had only the extravagant reports about Nero or Heliogabalus, another emperor who had, historians say, that's all he ever wanted. He was not interested in women. He would only take males. He would require some of the generals to come in and service him. If we only had reports about Nero or Heliogabalus marrying their favorites, we might ascribe it to conventional senatorial animus, just political blackballing of one another, although the extreme and unnecessary level of detail about the ceremonies would be striking. But there's plenty of evidence besides. Juvenal's Second Satire, written sometime in the early 2nd century, claims that recently a man of wealth and status was given away in marriage to a man, and he imagines the day is near when male-male marriages will take place publicly and be recorded in the state's registers. When we meet again, is it next week or the week after that there's spring break? Week after? Okay. Next week, we move from the intertestamental period. I think I've given enough evidence to say it's just not true that there is no historical precedent and that everything we're seeing, talking about, that's just new. Same-sex marriage, these relationships, open and approved and legal, that just never has existed. That's why those biblical statements can't possibly be contra those, can't be opposing those. I think we've taken the bite out of that claim. And so we're ready to move from the Old Testament and the intertestamental period in history to Jesus and Paul and the broader New Testament material. You have let me do history tonight, and most people don't like history. That's a shame. But you noticed I've stayed away from dates. I know that's the part you had. Father, thank you for letting us be together. Give safe travel home. Give us a day tomorrow to serve you in a way that would honor your name and bless those with whom we'll be in touch. Through Christ, amen. Thank you for being here, and good night.